Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the journalist and best-selling author Krista Tippett. Krista has her own series of podcasts from her On Being radio program that stretches back 15 years. In that time, Krista has interviewed a diverse array of inspirational people, including scientists, theologians, and artists. I talked to her about her experience of this and about her book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living, which draws on the wisdom of many of the people she has interviewed. We discuss this through the five key topics in her book, which are words, flesh, love, faith, and hope. Finally, we discuss the middle way and how this might relate to her work. Well, hello, Krista. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
So happy to be with you.
Okay, right. Well, I'm going to start off by probably embarrassing you a bit, Krista, by effusing about the book and what a wonderful treasure trove of little nuggets of wisdom and insights. And imagine what a privilege it must have been to have engaged in such a profound way with so many interesting people. I also found it very entertaining and moving at times, especially when you were talking about your own life and the challenges you've faced. For me, sometimes with non-fiction books, I can treat them a bit like medicine. I know they're good for me. And I give myself, you know, a regular dose of 20 or 30 pages. But your book really caught my attention. So thank you, first of all.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That means a lot because as you know, there's a lot of me in it, and yeah. it was a labor of love.
Okay. Well, now I know this is an impossible task, but could you just begin maybe by giving us a quick overview of the book and what you were hoping to achieve with it?
Yeah. So I've had this radio show and this kind of cumulative conversation now for almost 15 years with really speaking about the great questions of meaning and with all kinds of people, spiritual teachers and theologians, but also scientists and artists. And across the years, people have asked me, you know, what I'm learning and what are the recurring themes in these lives of beauty and wisdom and grace. And so that was the question that I was following when I set out to write the book. But as I wrote the book, I realized that it was actually really important that I do put myself into the picture, just because I know in a radio conversation that when somebody's willing to walk that line between what you know and how you like sort of what you know and what you do and who you are, that's actually what makes it listenable for other people and ignites their imagination. And so I ended up pursuing that question, but really putting myself on the line in terms of what I've learned, and it became much less. You know, in the beginning, I had all these lofty chapter titles about wisdom and beauty and mystery. And as I went through it, what felt really urgent for me to write about is that, you know, I have been privileged to interview just, you know, great lives, but they're not all famous. And I think they're spiritual geniuses, which is a phrase of Einstein, but also spiritual geniuses of the everyday. And we all know these people. And what felt really critical is that this is not something to put up on a pedestal, that wisdom is accessible to all of us, and it's accessible through the raw materials of each of our lives. And so the book really kind of very fitfully found its own shape, and it was much closer to the ground than I expected. So really I ended up just kind of delving into kind of five raw elements of the everyday: words, the body, love in all of its forms, faith, and hope.
Smashing. Well, I really sort of engage with that idea, the everyday wisdom. Sometimes I think we're a bit of afraid of wisdom. There's a saying that if you think you're wise, then you're not, and it's like almost like you're sort of putting on airs. But I didn't get that from the book at all. It was something that we should aspire to and try to cultivate.
Yes, and actually I think the fact that that wisdom is something that you can cultivate, I think, you know, is something actually a wonderful kind of empowering piece of knowledge that I have received from my conversation partners who are working as scientists in biology and social psychology and neuroscience, that we're actually learning that we can shape by the behaviors we choose, by the things we practice, whether they seem to be come naturally or be defining of us or not, we can move through the world differently, and we can actually start to change our biology and our brains. And I think with wisdom, you're right. It sounds it could sound presumptuous, and we also kind of have this stereotype of, old and wise, like it's something like wisdom is something you can only acquire if you live a very long time. And then, but one thing we know is that you everybody doesn't grow wise. Some people just grow old.
Yeah.
And right. So this is still something people have cultivated, but I also am really aware that I think wisdom, that there are different forms of wisdom that are possible and accessible at different stages of life, including, very young children have a particular kind of wisdom, and people in their 20s have this kind of urgent capacity to see the world whole, and that, there's a wisdom that comes in entering midlife, and then of course there is something very special about that wisdom late in life. But yeah, you're right that this is something that is there for all of us, and that at any stage of life, it's something we can be deepening in ourselves.
Sure, yeah. What you're saying about kids, I've often heard that children have this sort of lantern consciousness when when they're open to experience, and they're more open to,
yes,
to having their views can disconfirm, where we've got this sort of spotlight consciousness. And maybe the arts or even travel, sometimes we engage in that lantern consciousness that we have when we're a child. But we can learn a lot from kids. I learn a lot from my cat. Anyway, as you say, you've interviewed people from a very wide range of disciplines, vocations, professions and traditions. Would you say that, however, is there a certain thread running through all the talks? What do your guests perhaps all have in common?
Well, I guess there are some, as I say, when I first started thinking about this, I had an idea about chapters about something like mystery or virtues. And then I realized that there were things that do flow all the way through. And so I would say I like the language of virtues. I know it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah.
But to me, what it implies is again, practices that we choose to become certain ways, and that we start very simply. And again, we understand this better because how we're understanding our brains, that, just by doing something over and over again, whether it feels natural or not. I think of virtues as kind of spiritual technologies. And, our traditions have cultivated different virtues, but, but just like, learning to play the piano or throw a ball, we can decide that we want to become more compassionate or better listeners or more patient or more loving.
Yeah.
And it won't be perfect, but it's you can develop muscle memory around these things. So I would say that the people who, the wise lives I've interviewed, they've all done that. They've had an intentionality, and it's not romantic. And I guess the other thing, and this is not something we like to think about in the modern West, is that, as ironic as it is, as paradoxical as it is a truth of human life that our moments of crisis, that our moments of weakness, that the times when everything's come crashing down and it's not at all what we expected, or when we know our vulnerability and frailty through loss or illness, those are precisely the moments that are opportunities for growth. But what I would say, it's not that those things are overcome in lives of wisdom, but that it's an understanding that how we walk through them, things that we do not choose to walk through, right? But how we walk through them and then integrate them into the wholeness on the other side is the difference between, just wisdom, becoming wise, or just surviving.
Sure. You say that the crack in the middle is where you want to live and what you want to widen. Could you tell us a little bit what you mean by that? And do you think, again, is that what many of your interviewees are trying to do with their lives?
Yeah, so that actually was I was referring to a statement by a woman named Frances Kissling, who is very well known in the States as a pro-choice advocate, you know, in the abortion debate, which is a, you know, here a very fraught public conversation, or not even a conversation. And what she talked about is the crack in the middle between the people who have all the answers on both sides of the arguments. And that is, I would say, something that falls away in the way we do not just our public conversations, but I would say our common reflection on hard, important issues, is that we tend to turn it into a debate between competing answers.
Yeah.
And right, and we actually set up, and I listen to a lot of BBC4, so I know that this is not just an American issue.
Definitely.
We, you know, and we tend to set up and draw out the people who have all the, who have absolutely no questions left, and that does make for a good debate. But we are living in this moment where we have these vast, kind of intimate, civilizational issues that we just need to ponder for a while. And I think, and I would say, you know, to your question, that wise people take in nuance, and you know, and they live with, they take complexity seriously, and they don't rush to simplify. And I do actually believe, actually, you know, that crack in the middle, I mean, I do believe that most of us, you know, on any given subject are somewhere to the left or the right of those voices who have no questions left alongside their answers and no curiosity about the other side. But we're not very practiced at speaking to each other and with each other in that place, and listening to each other. And I think we must, right?
Yeah.
Because these hard issues that we're up against, I mean, we can pretend that the complexity is not there, but it is going to come back and haunt us, nevertheless.
Yeah, I also like what Francis said about common ground, especially, you know, if you're in a situation where your views are quite opposed, that can actually be not very effective. In fact, actually gets in the way of, and the key thing is just to actually listen and try to understand and let the other person feel heard.
Yeah, that rushing to common ground, while it sounds like a noble and lofty desire, can actually prematurely cut short a hard conversation that needs to happen.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to the first chapter in the book, which you entitle Words. Now, one of your interviewees, Rachel Naomi, is it Naomi Raymond? She said sometimes we need a story more than food in order to live. What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think that is another thing that my life of conversation has taught me. And I feel that, you know, this is an ancient truth, right? This is something human beings knew forever. And we still gather around the fireside every night to hear stories, although a lot of it is, you know, the TV set or what's on our computers. But I think that, we kind of pretended for a few generations that stories are just entertainment, right? And that's something separate from facts and, you know, the narrative of reality. And I think that by confining ourselves too much to facts, we've come up with kind of an impoverished sense of the truth. And the story of our time, you know, the story of actually who we are and what we're capable of. And, you know, Rachel Naomi Remen is a doctor, and she started to make that observation, seeing that, you know, in her practice as a doctor, people could come in with diabetes or heart disease or Crohn's disease, which she suffers from. And there's a way you could analyze that through the textbook, and you could talk about treatments. But in fact, the story of each of these people's lives made the story of their illness completely distinct, and also the story of their potential healing. And I think you can apply that actually in every sphere, but it's almost, again, it's an ancient thing that we know, but we've lost our vocabulary for this kind of wisdom in public life. And so we kind of have to learn to think and speak in this way together again.
Yeah, she also talked about generous listening.
Yeah.
And that's something I have to say. I've listened to quite a few of your podcasts, and you seem to be a practitioner of that. Is that something?
Yeah, well, thank you.
Is that a skill that you've really cultivated yourself through doing these interviews? Do you think
Yes. And it's right. It's something I've practiced, and it's muscle memory. I guess I feel I like her phrase generous listening. I always feel that it's necessary to when talking about listening to add a word like generous because we've kind of flattened out the notion of listening, I think, to being quiet while the other person says what they have to say so that I can finally say what I have to say. I mean, that's kind of how we practice listening in political life. And, listening, generous listening, is actually about bringing a quality of generosity. Again, like you choose this. It's not necessarily that you feel generous, but this is something, this is a way you choose to walk into the room, into the conversation. And I think it has attendant qualities like a sense of hospitality, a basic kind of curiosity, an openness to being surprised, which sounds really simple, but if you think about the way we do politics in the West, the last thing we do is walk into a room willing to be surprised. Like we know who those other people are. We know who they voted for. We know what they believe. And in fact, we don't. Partly because, as we were just saying, we don't know their story. We don't know what motivates them. And without knowing that, we also can't know how we can really engage with them at a human level. And perhaps by having a conversation there, walk eventually into a place where we can navigate some territory differently together.
It reminds me of something in my own experience. I'm what's called a Samaritan. I don't know if you have a similar service in
Oh.
there. And what the Samaritan's about basically is about listening, but we call it active listening. And it's
Right. Same thing. Yeah.
we don't have any message, we don't have any answers. We're just one human being, just really trying to understand another human being. And that can be really powerful.
It's such a gift, actually, right? It's such a gift to give someone, to be there to actively listen to them. And it's rarer than it should be. I mean, I think listening is a basic social art, but it's another one of these things that we kind of forgot and now we have to kind of relearn.
Okay, something else I really loved in the book. You said when it comes to questions such as, for example, who God is, how to approach the problem of evil, what is prayer, etc., you say that you can disagree with someone's opinion, but you can't disagree with their experience.
Yes, and if we can understand, if we can muster some curiosity for someone's experience, then we are actually going to be able to approach their position differently, right? We're going to be able to have a more human, complicated, possibly confusing, encounter with them. But which will hold so much more promise in terms of just how we live together, whether we agree or not.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next chapter, which you entitle Flesh. You say that you've come to believe that our capacity to reach beyond ourselves, experiencing mystery or being present to others, is dependent on how fully we are planted in our bodies, in all their flaws and their grace. Now, that personally really resonates with me. I spend a lot of time, Krista, in my head, but I do find I do personally find meditation and Tai Chi, that's my thing, very helpful in reminding me that I'm very much made of flesh and blood. Now, you're a yoga practitioner. How is that integrative in your own life?
Yoga came along at a point in my life where I was so sick of the thoughts in my head, and I had lived a very cerebral life. And there's a lot of, I love ideas, and I love questions, and I love books, and but I really think if I hadn't started doing yoga or something that had gotten me into my body, I would have stalled, right? I couldn't actually. It's a kind of statement that I can hardly explain in logical terms myself, but I think I know it, and you know it, that if I hadn't gotten more into my body, more embodied, and which also means, having a real physical sense of vulnerability and frailty, but which also is just about being reality based, right? Like that can sound like a downer, but in fact, it's about living in reality. Yeah. So, and yoga is the thing that helped me do that. And it was great to kind of start doing yoga in midlife and not be good at it and actually go into it as something that I wasn't doing to be good at. I was just, but it stilled my thoughts and it made me more complete.
I imagine it's a nice thing that you can be. Do you think I can still be doing this in my 80s and 90s if I'm still around then as well? And what seems this whole embodied thing seems a very important theme to all your conversations. You talked earlier about from neuroscience we've got this idea of plasticity, and I imagine it must be also very heartening for you that again neuroscience and psychology is now challenging these. The mind, body, reason, emotion, facts, values, objectivity, subjectivity dichotomies that we've arguably been beset with, especially since the Enlightenment.
Yeah, it turns out that we were seeing divisions and distinctions and separation, which were just about the limits of our understanding. And I think people will look back at us talking about mind, body, spirit and say, you know, those primitive, you know, those barbarians, because in fact, what we're learning is that there's just this incredible interplay all the time between what we've thought of as mind and brain and body and emotion, and thought and consciousness. They are all of a piece. And, you know, I'm so fascinated by some of the things that are being learned in the field of trauma studies, you know, that, you know, trauma doesn't just, it's not just memories, it's not thoughts in people's heads, it's trauma lodges in our bodies, actually memories lodge in our bodies, and that there are things that where we've been so focused on talk therapy that there are wounds that can be better healed just physically, at least first, and you know, just really taking that on and healing there. So this is one of the ways that we're understanding things that are, I think, really unlocking our human potential for self-knowledge, for being healing forces to ourselves and others, you know, in ways that are really exciting. And it's hard because this is happening at the same moment that you know, on national and global levels, there's a lot that feels like we're going backwards. But the, you know, the picture I have of our time is very much this both and, right? This potential, well, this potential for destruction, but also for incredible creativity.
Sure. Yeah, I often think, you know, we're bombarded in the news by negative stuff, but I think we're also maybe it's an adaptive thing that we're more attuned to negative news. Like, I mean, in the sense that, you know, when we're on the savannah, it made more sense to listen into the idea that was a saber-toothed tiger in that valley than there was some strawberries in the other one. But that sells newspapers, doesn't it?
Yes, and you're so right that, I mean, our body, and again, this gets at our that we are actually having, it's not, it's, you know, we think it's about reading, but in fact, it's about physical things that are being set off in our brains. We're attuned to be looking for threats, right? And to be riveted by fear, and then to kind of gear up in ways that actually begin physically and then feel like ideas. And somehow, I don't know, somehow I feel like journalism is, you know, the way it came into to us from the 20th century to the 21st is no longer serving us, is bad for us. And I think it's going to have to change, but it will be a slow, painful transition.
Sure. And then you also say in the book that you really love murder mysteries and you wouldn't like to have a life without murder mysteries. And they are, you know, these sort of archetypal stories, they really interest us as a human, you know, as human beings, don't they? And life would be lesser for it, but I think we just have to put them in perspective.
And murder mysteries and, you know, fairy tales, which are so unbelievably violent, especially in their originals. But, you know, I talked a couple years ago to this scholar who works with fairy tales and with stories. And she said, you know, those stories are about giving us safe, contained ways to reckon with these places in our brains that are that get riveted by this. But somehow we have to get, yeah, as you're saying, we have to grow up as a species, and I think we're getting the tools to do that.
I was really moved by your chapter on love and your experience of it. For you, what is love, and how has your view of it changed and evolved throughout your life? I know that's a very big question.
It is a huge question, but I can say that, and I wrote about this. I think the big evolution for me recently, in the last few years, has been an understanding of how I had narrowed, had a kind of narrowed imagination about love. And I feel that this is culturally true as well, that, you know, we're so riveted by Eros, and I'm sure that's, we can blame our brains for that too. That there are some, I just, you know, through a number of experiences, including, you know, getting a divorce, I realized that I, at some point in my life, was walking around, although I was quite happy in so many ways, with this idea in my head that I felt was a truth and a fact, that I didn't have love in my life. And then, you know, somehow was jolted into understanding that I have so much love in my life. I have so many forms of love in my life, even if I didn't have that one. And then I think, you know, that kind of romantic love. And I also, very much through my conversations, I mean, you know, I would say the wise people I interview in many fields, I don't know if loving is a word some of them would use about themselves, but I would also say that is a quality of their presence in the world. And I am longing, as I think many of us are, for us to really take on, like, figure out what love could look like as something that we do in our common life, that we practice with our neighbors who now are strangers. I think many of us really long. Of course, we all long to be loved. But I think we also long to love and to love well, and for that not to just be private.
Sure.
And certainly not just romantic. I hear the word surfacing in unexpected places that I don't think it would have a couple of years ago. I think this is something that we have to accompany each other in, right? That somehow we all, each of us in our own way, has to become more bold and holding this intention, maybe using this language or words around it appropriately. And again, practicing it.
Yeah.
And really practical love, you know, the agape love of the New Testament, that had practical care, that has absolutely nothing to do about how you feel about someone or even if you know them, right? It's something bigger and it's something much more concrete.
You know, again, I agree, Krista. A few years ago, I used to, with my partner, we used to have a walking holiday business in Spain. And we used to do this walk starting off in March and April and go through the summer. And in March and April, there were only a few people on the walk, and you'd always have time to say hello to those people and even have a bit of a chat to them. But once it came to May and June, the density of people got so much, you just stopped. It was just too much to actually say hello and engage in that way. And I wonder if sometimes if that, you know, that we live in bigger numbers, I wonder if that sometimes can have a, you know, like when you get on the London Underground, is that people are just
yeah.
so frightened and they're all hiding. We're all hiding
yeah.
behind our newspapers.
Yes. But I also fear that we even act that way in our neighborhoods with people who live right around us, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're
yeah.
right.
And it's not about, when I say I want us to hold an intention to love and find ways to make it really robust and practical, I'm not talking about getting you know, airy fairy and abstract, and I'm not talking about romanticizing public life, because, you know, if we do that, it won't work. But I think we could each try to start really small, right? Just something. Maybe it's like, it's how you are at work,
yeah.
And it or it's how you are online, right? Because that's another place
right.
we spend our lives now, and that's another place we meet other people.
Yeah, no, but that's a very good example, because I think going back to the idea of embodiment, I mean, often that's gets in the way. It's a bit like when you're in a car, isn't it? You can be a lot sort of ruder in a way in a car, because you're in this
yes.
bubble. And I think there's something going on there with the internet at times as well, especially with the public shaming that goes on Twitter and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to the next chapter. This one's on faith. And there was I found a very interesting quote by Anne Lamott, who says, "The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty." What
Yeah,
did you think of
right.
it? I thought it was great. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I love it because I believe in questions as sacred things, sacred tools, and powerful tools, and a powerful form of words. And, you know, this notion of seeking and seekers, which even just a couple of generations ago, that was a separate category of people, and you know, and it could be very superficial. But I actually think that seekers, you know, are everywhere, and that the seekers inside our traditions are the ones who are going to, you know, restore them and revive them for the changing world. And there's something, you know, there's something very mysterious and powerful about holding faith and questions in a kind of constant enlivening interplay.
That's
So I think her quote is just, it just makes so much sense to me.
no, me too. And then sticking with mystery, there's a wonderful excerpt from the book where Robert Coles is quoting Flannery O'Connor, which I'd love to read out if you don't mind. As it seems to get to the heart for me in many ways of what I at least understood what your book is about. So this is what he says. He says, "She said beautifully, the task of the novelist is to deepen mystery." And then she pauses and says, "But mystery is a great embarrassment to the modern mind, and there's our tragedy, that we have to resolve the mystery. We can't let it be. We can't rejoice in it. We can't celebrate it. We can't affirm it as an aspect of our lives, because after all, mystery is an aspect of our lives, and mystery, you bet, is a great challenge, but it's also an invitation and a wonderful companion." Now, Krista, I consider myself a spiritual or perhaps even a religious person, but what I mean by that is I suppose I mean trying to come to terms or reconciling myself with my existential condition and life's great mysteries, but not positing any final answers. How might that relate to your own view of spirituality?
You know, I would say sometimes people ask me what is the biggest effect all these conversations have had on you know, this over time, and if there's an answer to that question, it is that my sense of mystery just grows more expansive, and also I just delight in it, right? And so I would say, kind of like you, I less and less have a need to tie things up. I just don't have a need to do it, which is, you know, which coexists with the fact that I feel like I have such reverence, right, for you know, for the mystery, what I can know at this moment in time, what I do believe, but how that coexists with everything that is yet to be known and yet to be discovered. I had this conversation with a geneticist a few years ago who talked about the spirituality of the scientist and the mystic as being akin to each other. And it was about, you know, he said the scientist as the mystic, you know, has absolute reverence for what he or she can know, but also lives in this great expectancy and delight in what is yet to come, what is yet to be discovered. And I think, I mean, that kind of describes the way you have talked about yourself, and I think the place I've also come to.
Okay, you say in many ways you see the new dynamics of spiritual life in our time as gifts to the wisdom of the ages, even as they unsettle the foundations of faith as we've known it for what feels like forever. We talked a little bit before about falsification. In this regard, do you feel this process, this disconfirmation or challenge is making spiritual life more resilient or anti-fragile?
I think that our religious structures that we've inherited, like, you know, the organizational structures, the systems of authority, a lot of it doesn't really make sense in the 21st century. And that's true actually of all of our institutions and structures, you know, schools and prisons and medicine. Like, they don't quite make sense anymore. So in that sense, I think religion is just, it's part of a larger cultural shift. So it has to figure out what it is. It's going to have to reinvent itself. And I really do feel like the forces for spiritual renewal are certainly deep inside the traditions, but also the people who are outside, but who are asking. You know, if you're talking about Robert Coles a minute ago, who talked about the spiritual lives of children, like, and one of the things he says is, you know, children ask the burning questions of religion across the ages, that inquiry, like, where did we come from? Where are we going? Why do people die? Why are people mean to each other? I mean, you know, these are the basic questions of morality. And there are a lot of people and a lot of young people, increasing numbers of young people who haven't grown up with any kind of traditional religious formation, but who are posing those questions insistently to themselves and to modern society, and wanting those questions to be a commitment to those questions to be part of their integrity as human beings, and they're often not associating themselves with the traditions, but they also don't have a lot of baggage. So you know, they are engaging in some ways. You know, they may be engaging with social justice that connects to the traditions, or you know, they are spiritually or theologically curious. So I really see in all of this energy the forces that even from the outside may bring our traditions back to their deepest heart. And that's always what has happened, you know. That's what the monastics did. I think that's, you know, what the Reformation tried to do. And that's what all the new denominations have done across time. I mean, that's what Anglicanism was doing in its way, right? What is truly core here? And can we describe it in language and liturgies that are, you know, just that much more present and relevant to people? But it's happening in our century in this interesting way, I think, from the outside as much as the inside.
Sure. Well, I hope so too. Okay. Well, on that subject, the final chapter is about hope, in which there's a talk with Brené Brown about shame and vulnerability. What do they have to do with hope?
Brené Brown is a scholar. She's a social work researcher, and so her insights come through you know, clinical research. And she has studied how people, so, you know, here's one of these things. It's like, you know, again, an ancient truth about all of us, which we, in our clever modernity, have been able to cover up temporarily, that, you know, that we remain vulnerable across the span of our lives. But what, you know, what Brené has articulated so beautifully is that, you know, hope is a function of struggle. You know, I kind of alluded to this a while ago that, and I think especially as parents, I mean, the conversation I had with her as a parent was really important to me, because I don't know, there's something about raising children in this time where we want to give them the most perfect life we can. I think it has a lot of, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons that this happened. But in fact, forgetting that, this basic truth, if we all think about the moments that made us who we are, they were moments when we got through something we didn't know how we could walk through, right? It's those moments of uncertainty where you had to be resilient and creative, or you survived something. And so that's what, you know, she talked about hope as a function of struggle, hope that emerges from us encountering our vulnerability and walking through it and with it. And that, you know, again, it's countercultural in a way, but it's making us more reality based. And hope, as you know, I write about hope as, to me, very distinct from optimism, not about wishful thinking, about, again, muscle memory that we can develop, about a choice that we can make, that we can practice. And we do it, I think, for our own health and joy, but we also do it in service to the world.
Yeah. What gives you hope, Krista?
Oh, I so much gives me hope, and I beautiful lives give me hope, and there are beautiful lives everywhere. And there's, you know, there is so much resilience in the making, and there's so, you know, all around us, there are people in service to others, and there's healing going on, and there's creativity and innovation kind of remaking these structures that don't work anymore in more generative and humane ways. And I absolutely hold my sense of that together with my sense of the terrible things that are happening in the world, right? I mean, that's not the whole story. But as you said a little while ago, the terrible, destructive, catastrophic side of the human story at any given moment is what is getting all the publicity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my hope, it is a choice that I make, and it comes with the conviction that it's very important for each of us in whatever way we can to insist on the reality of what is good and beautiful and that's happening right now as well, to shine a light on that, to make hope the reasonableness of hope, to reveal it as more reasonable than you might think if you based your entire view of reality on what you read in the newspaper today.
Okay. You say at one point in the book, our experience, our story, is some way the only real thing. Now, the middle way, as we understand it in the middle way society, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience. So we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. Now, we've talked about messiness earlier, but it's arguably that in the messy, uncertain middle that we actually start to get to grips perhaps more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Oh, it's I actually love the word messy.
Me too.
And I think the word middle, I think the middle, in fact, is so much bigger than either of the poles, right? Like, to me, the middle is the vast majority of us. Between those poles where there are no answers and where there is, frankly, a pretense, and it is absolutely a pretense that this is all, that anything is simple, right?
Yeah.
In the messiness, in acknowledging and honoring it and choosing to be there with ourselves and with others, we become more whole. I mean, that's the only place we can be whole. And in fact, it's the only place where we can cultivate the raw materials for continuing to grow and evolve and rise, be more and more our best selves. And I feel that that modern people long to be called to be their best selves. And in fact, we're more often kind of called and cajoled into being our base selves, right? Our consumer selves or our partisan selves. But in choosing to honor that mystery, you know, we have the potential, to really, you know, I almost want to use the word transcendence. I think to transcend, not to be perfect, right?
Yeah.
But I really do, Teilhard de Chardin is a figure in the book, and he spoke of such a thing as spiritual evolution that would be an obvious successor to physical evolution. And it would be about, you know, it would be about us being able to deepen our capacity to love, and in that way transcending you know, the cruel things that we're capable of, which again get all the attention, and that only happens in that vast middle that you're describing.
Sure. Okay, well, two final questions, Krista. To what degree has this endeavor, you know, doing all the interviews, changed you, do you think?
Oh, it's, as I say, it's made me more appreciative of mystery as a companion, as Robert Coles said. You know, it has definitely given me a sense of nuance and complexity, in everything. And in fact, instead of being burdensome, that brings such a sense of relief when you completely get rid of the idea that you have to be able to pin everything down or tie it up or explain it or, you know, or be perfect in any way.
Okay.
So there, it's relaxed. I'm more relaxed. Let's say that, which also comes with age, I think.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound lofty, but in my life, that's a big accomplishment.
Great. Okay. And my final question, what is wisdom?
I think the simplest way that I have to describe wisdom is that it's distinct from knowledgeable or intelligent. I think it's connected to those things. But I think that the litmus test of wisdom, that it's not a possession. It may be something that we look at a wise person and we know this and we say they're wise. But the measure of the wisdom is not just something they possess, but it is in the imprint they make on the world around them and on other lives. That's how I think about wisdom and how it is additive, how it is something more expansive than knowledge.
Great. Okay. Well, as I said at the beginning, Krista, I really loved your book, and I'd just like to end with a quote you wrote on virtually the final page. You said, "We are so achingly frail and powerful all at once in this adolescence of our species, but I have seen that wisdom emerges precisely through those moments when we have to hold seemingly opposing realities in a creative tension and interplay. Power and frailty, birth and death, pain and hope, beauty and brokenness, mystery and conviction, calm and buoyancy, mine and yours." To me, that's such a beautiful expression of the middle way. So anyway, so thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure for me too.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.